Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of What Most People Think. And last week we had a stunning debut from Scott Capurro, so do check out that episode. But this week is What Most People Think Royalty is Simon Evans. Welcome back to the show, Simon.
What Most People Think is Royalty. That's me, is it?
I think it's both those things. You've definitely got the voice for it. And it's a real shame that people, I mean, on YouTube they might be able to see it, but your bookshelf up in the corner, I can't, it's very, I'm seeing.
Hang on a minute. I'm going to get it for you.
I'm suspecting that there might be some problematic books in here.
Can you
talk us through what we can see here?
Okay. I mean, it's extremely heavy. So I'll talk you through. That is my specially selected problematic bookshelf. And it consists of Simon Heffer's biography of Enoch Powell, Like the Roman, the Sir Oswald Mosley's own autobiography, fascinating read that one.
Strong choice.
We Are Doomed by John Derbyshire, a trenchant right-wing reactionary in America. The Age of Entitlement by Christopher Caldwell, laying the blame for America's present woes at the feet of the civil rights legislation in the mid-60s.
Okay, so I'm getting a flavour. Yeah. So is this that you're kind of hoping that people will notice?
Well, there was a few years ago, I don't remember, I think Michael Gove did a Zoom call and somebody zoomed in on, was it archaeofuturism? One of the sort of new right French, I can't remember his name, But everyone became very interested in what books you could isolate in a mainstream politician's bookshelf that would show that they had a bit of a dark side to them.
There you go. So you've gone.
So I deliberately curated one for that purpose. I'm going to put it back now because it's extraordinarily heavy.
So I would say that if you're new to What Most People Think, we have a range of guests on. And one thing that somebody said, there was a really nice review, but somebody said that not all the guests are my cup of tea. But that's what I like. I like the fact that people that listen to this are challenged. There's far too many podcasts that are the same two people every week having a cozy little chat about minor disagreements between them, whereas This one, it's a bit of like one of those mystery boxes, you know, like the kids like now where you get a prize and you don't know what the fuck is in it. I've gone against all the podcast rules and you never know, you might have a Simon Evans this week, you might have a Mark Steele the following week. I would say as well, Simon, is that, you know, I was sad to see that the headliners, the GB News show, is that now finished, is it?
They have officially cancelled it for the time being at any rate. We are working out our notice period, those of us who had contracts there. Some people were on a sort of gig basis and others, I had a contract. So I'm still employed by them until November. And they introduce us into the final hour. It's now Patrick Christie's has 3 hours from 9 till midnight and they bring a headliner on most nights and send one of the previous guests home. So he normally has three people on his panel from 9 till 11, and one of those goes home and a headliner is slotted in. So there's still a little bit of a headliner flavour on the show.
So you're sort of doing that kind of chat that I do on the Jeremy Vine show, just the sort of like the right-wing version of that panel-type news chat.
Yeah, well, of course, obviously, they are quite balanced, to be fair, Patrick Christie's normally has a right and a left, and it's left on. Nina Mishkoff, for instance, I've been on every time against her. And the first time there was a bit of a collision, a bit of a flare-up over her friend Esther Ranson, who I mocked gently. I can give you the details if you want. But
go ahead. I'm totally looking for gossip and juicy. That's why I brought
It wasn't exactly. It was, to be fair, it was probably more to do with the headline writer, but when they passed the assisted dying bill or when it seemed to, it was heading off after the Lords, and it had the wind at his back. And the Mirror headline said, this is a wonderful present for Dame Esther Ranson, who celebrates her 85th birthday this week or something, a birthday she had feared she would not live to see. I was like, I'm not sure you can say you fear you're not going to live to see a birthday when the whole point of your campaign is your right to kill yourself before you get there. And Nina was unhappy about that. But we've started to form a bit of a rapport since. I think there's a little bit of a, you know, potentially a Michael Portillo, Diane Abbott thing going on now. So we'll hopefully we'll be cozying up on the sofa soon. Yeah.
No, and it sounds like an interesting chemistry, too strong a word, but yeah, people should check it out.
A remarkably well-preserved 79-year-old Mishkov.
Yeah, no, I've worked with her on the Jeremy Vine show. She looks fantastic. Although, you know, she obviously has an amazing brain as well. We shouldn't reduce women just to how well-preserved they are.
Her brain is as well-preserved as any part of her.
Beautiful, sir. What a gentleman. On this show, if you are listening in your early stage of listening to this podcast, what we do is we basically take the big political stories of the week, and then we'll take something sort of social or topical, and then for the patrons, we'll have the Patreon only, where we'll get our teeth into something else. And this week, the main subject is Labour versus the unions. At the back end of last week, Unite disowned Angela Rayner. So we'll be talking about that and Wes Streeting going head-to-head with the BMA. There's also news that there are now trigger warnings increasingly on noughties comedies. We had it for the 70s. I think every 70s comedy was a trigger warning in itself in many ways. And so we're going to talk about that, and also some of the reaction to the new Superman film, where some people on the right are getting a little bit obsessed about whether films are woke or not. And in the Patreon only, the Oasis reunion has started really strongly, and it seems to have quite a cultural resonance. And we'll be discussing whether or not this will finally herald the return of noisy working class blokes with guitars. New patrons, if you join the Patreon, just go to the website. It's better for me. I see more of the money. You'll get the podcast early, ad-free, and with bonus content. And, of course, you'll get a name roast. We'll just take your name and speculate all sorts of unflattering things about it. Now, this week, we've got a few names. John Simmon. John Simmon feels like it's missing an S there. It's normally Simmons, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, it should be, of the Simmons.
Yeah, what, have you done that yourself? You know, like they're like we've got in our industry, Sean Walsh added an N, John Richardson removed an H. Do you think this is a bit of jiggery-pokery with the name here?
Keith Richards was Keith Richard or something. I can't remember which way round he went.
When it works, it does make you disgust them more. So attention-seeking John
Marvin
Simmons.
Gay definitely added an E so that he wasn't just gay. I remember that.
Anthony Ray. That's quite a cool name, isn't it? Anthony. It looks like Anthony Ray has also maybe added a letter in there. But Anthony Ray, maybe he's one of the few male fiction writers still selling books at this point.
There were a few high-achieving Rays in the art. Weren't they? I was Satyajit Ray, I think, was a great Indian film director, and Johnny Ray was the Morris's hero, who used to sing with a hearing aid in, which he genuinely needed, and Morrissey affected to wear one in honour of Johnny Ray.
And I think there was Christopher Ray.
Sounded sad upon the radio, broke a million hearts in mono. That was from Dexys Midnight Runners. Remember that?
Bit before my time, mate. Bit before my time. Youngster here. More Oasis, you know, the cool young stuff. Okay. There was also Christopher Ray, who played for Arsenal. So you mentioned all these cultured things, and I just said, oh, yeah, there was a forward for Arsenal. There's Tom Gilbert there. That's quite a... Tom Gilbert sounds like you'd be part of a sketch troupe at the Edinburgh Fringe.
Yeah.
You know, the one that has to set up the sketches, the smart one that can actually talk to the audience. Okay, guys, so this next sketch, okay, we're going to need three things. We're going to need a situation, we're going to need a kind of film, and we're going to need a politician with a weird name. I mean, the weird thing about that kind of improv is it does actually work quite well at the Fringe, but it's fucking irritating, isn't it?
Well, it's great fun to do improv. That's the thing. The tough part is making your experience, your joy of doing it, communicate to the audience without coming over as,
like a Tom Gilbert.
Yeah.
Like a Tom Gilbert, frankly.
I like Gilbert name, though. And so my son has a middle name, Gilbert, which I chose specifically.
It's a likeable name. Tom Gilbert, very English. The moment he hits 27, he'll quit the sketch troupe and join a hedge fund. Andrew, just a one-namer. So we will presume from this that Andrew is part of a woke institution and is protecting his identity. I would say that Andrew maybe is the guy that has to add the trigger warnings to noughties comedies against his better judgment.
Unless he is. There is a royal protocol that you don't give a surname. So we might be talking about the actual Prince Andrew. I mean, that is possible.
He who shall not sweat. Yeah.
Exactly.
Lord Peter Mort. so we've got David Domain, as you know, he's a super patron who keeps an eye on previous things. He's absolutely on fire with the info that he's picking up on for previous episodes here. So the first British Gay Pride March, I was wondering when that happened. Would you have a stab year-wise at when you think the first one was?
Well, I remember there was that movie where they formed an unlikely alliance with the Welsh miners, didn't they? So that must have been about 1984. So I'm going to go with 1981.
81. It was earlier still, 1972 in London, in the House of Lords. In the House of, well, he says brackets, House of Lords Library. Oh, I think maybe you got it from the House of Lords Library. Was it in the House of Lords Library? We'll have to pick that one up. And the abbreviation LBT would need some more vowels in it. I was calling it an acronym. It is, in fact, an initialism.
Yeah.
So it's the kind of
acronym you have to be able to say it, don't you? Lugabe.
Lugabe. Yeah. That's good. I didn't know. This is why I always need you on, laughing and learning. I always feel a bit more intelligent after we do a show together. I was with Scott Capuro, we were praising Joan Rivers, and we were talking about this kind of comedy urban myth that she did a 9/11 joke the day afterwards. It turns out that is a bit of an apocryphal tale. She did it a 9/11 joke during a gig in London in 2002. The joke concerned the widows of firefighters. Immediately go, well, this is good Joan Rivers territory, a joke about the widows of firefighters that were killed in the attack. Rivers said that they would be disappointed if their husbands had been found alive because they would be forced to return the money they'd received in compensation. I mean, that's pretty uncompromising.
It's a strong joke, but it wasn't enough to kill her for, unlike the one about Michael Obama.
I also spoke about having gone to see a musical about Live Aid and just remembering the output of Phil Collins, both in solo and in Genesis, just how good it was, how many hits, how catchy they were, and why we don't hear from him. And apparently he's in quite serious poor health these days. So
I went to see Genesis about 2 or 3 years ago in Manchester. It was just a night off on a tour and it fitted in. So I spent, it was nearly £200 for the ticket, and it was really heartbreaking. He was led onto the stage on crutches and seated down in a chair. He can't drum anymore. Sang well, but it was horrible to watch, you know. He was amazing, possibly because he was tempted to fly across the Atlantic so he could drum in 2 gigs on the same day. That sort of lifestyle was finally did for him, I think.
Well, I was thinking if I was Joan Rivers, she would do a joke about, well, didn't he have a song, I Can't Dance, I Can't Walk? I mean, that would have been just too much emotionally. The thing about Phil Collins and the Tories, so this was interesting. He was always one of those artists that was associated with the Tories. It's apparently a myth. And if people want to look into that, there's a YouTube clip explaining it. I always thought he seemed like a Tory. I wasn't anti him being a Tory, but yeah.
Phil Collins, well, the famous quote was that he was going to emigrate to Switzerland, wasn't he, if Labour got in. So that does sound a bit Tory, but, you know, I think
could
he was
be
already
really anti-Labour, I suppose, yeah.
People, rock stars do tend to have, like, one set of principles for public consumption, another set of principles for the tax man and the accountant, don't they? You know, that's just how it rolls. I mean, Bono is, you know, firmly in that category, isn't he?
I mean, I love Bono, just correcting your pronunciation.
Bono,
but,
sorry.
Yeah, the thing with U2's tax, I remember about that, it was after the drop the debt thing for the third world that it came to light. And The Edge, when asked about it, The Edge said, well, I think everybody wants to be tax efficient, don't they? Which is the least rock and roll thing that I think anyone has ever said about anything.
What most people think.
The thank you and the fuck you. I'm going to do both today, and I think Simon's going to jump on. Firstly, the thank you. Test cricket, amazing. As we're talking, England are attempting to bowl out India. God willing, we've taken a couple of wickets. But on Saturday night, it boiled over because there'd been an increasing amount of pettiness in the game. India and England both delaying, not in any rush. Shubman Gill, the Indian captain, had got a 7-minute massage on the pitch just to allow his wicketkeeper time to open the batting or something. It was all like proper shithousery. And then England unexpectedly had to go out to bat late on Saturday, and they only wanted to face one over. So they came out late. They strolled to the wicket. 3 times, Zach Crawley took his guard and then stepped away, citing some sort of imaginary punter moving behind the side screen. I mean, this really isn't cricket. And then he got hit. Well, the ball actually hit his finger. And I don't think he was injured, but suddenly you could see that it occurred to him, oh, if I step away and take my glove off and get the physio on, then I'll be able to waste more time. And it was brilliant. The Indians lost their rag. There was fucking swearing. And it was just a reminder, I suppose, that everyone talks about the gentility of cricket, but those odd moments of rancour and hostility really make it.
If you say so. I don't tend to watch the big test matches. I'll keep an ear open on the background, but I can't stay interested for hours on end in front of any sport, I'm afraid.
But the rewards were there when the shithousery starts. Yeah. But all right, we'll try you on this. My fuck you is for the tennis. I don't know if you've... First up, are you a tennis guy?
No, I haven't watched a single match this Wimbledon, I'm afraid. I haven't watched a single match.
One thing you might have been conscious of is shots of celebrities at the tennis. Now, tennis was always a society event. It always has been. But it feels like because there are less and less opportunities for celebs to hit a mass audience, they have to take the moments that do exist, right? So evidently, sitting at Wimbledon in a beautiful linen suit or a peach fucking dress or whatever, and then just go, oh, it's I do believe that's Tom Holland in, or that's Eddie Redmayne, or fuck any one of these chances just sitting there. And I want to interview them. I think the stress, they should have to do a live interview and a general knowledge test about tennis.
Somebody did one of these. John Cena, is that how you pronounce it? Ex-wrestler.
John Cena, yeah.
He was very funny. There was about a three-minute interview where they interviewed him about Wimbledon, questions like what's the main source of nutrition there, i.e. strawberries, and he said burgers, and how short should the grass be, and he said about 2 inches, and it's just under a centimetre, in fact, and all this sort of stuff. But he was very funny about it, you know, to be fair. I suspect there is a lot of that, isn't there? Yeah, I think Hugh Grant fell asleep, didn't he? On camera. I think I saw a clip of that, of him snoozing just behind Camilla.
But that's authentic behaviour. I sort of think, obviously I'm nowhere near the profile that I would be invited. I mean, you get the sense that there are some that are invited and some that are like, oh, I need to be there, so I'm going to pay and hope that I get seen in the crowd. And I'm not either of those things, but if I would get on it. I would be smashed. I would be Hugh Grant. I would drink too much. It's better that I'm not there. But I think I would only go to a sporting event if I had some interest. And sadly, you know, you go to the darts, it's not the same. You're not making the style pages of the Sunday Times.
Well, I think the people who go and see the darts pay to go and see the darts. I think almost, you know, you're talking about the tip of the iceberg with your Hugh Grants and your John Cena's. I think almost everybody in the Wimbledon in the centre court on the big days is there on hospitality tickets of one kind or another. I mean, my next door neighbour who works in the music industry went to see the women's final, which I think lasted about 38 minutes or something.
Six love. That was embarrassing, wasn't it?
The double bagel they call it, which I think is odd. I would have gone for donut. I don't know why it's bagel, but or Lerf, of course. Love as in Lerf is because it's the egg, isn't it? Is that right? The zero?
Oh, is that what it is?
I mean, love. It's a corruption of Lerf, yeah. The egg, as in the duck's egg for cricket as well, yeah. It all comes back to the egg sooner or later. Yeah.
It's like we've got David Domain live on the show. Lovely stuff. Okay, right, from centre court to the centre of British politics, terrible link, but we're going to talk about Labour in increasing number of standoffs against the unions. So Labour versus the unions, right? So they've pissed off people on the left. Oh, by the way, there was another poll about Starmer's popularity, which I am sort of enjoying. He's now, his disapproval rating is up there with Boris Johnson post-Partygate, which I have to say, that's surprisingly low. But I mean, you also have to give credit to Labour. They said that they were going to be proactive in Parliament. And by God, when it comes to polling, they really have achieved significant movement. But they've pissed off the left of their own party on welfare, on certain social issues and on immigration. Now they're getting into beef with the unions because late last week, the Unite Union locked horns with Angela Rayner. But I think renouncing or disassociated, there was a bloody word for it, associated.
Suspended
Angela Rayner and reassessing their relationship with Labour. And what I thought was interesting about this, not to be reductive and a bit base, but the Unite is headed up by Sharon Graham, right? Proper working class woman of the North. Angela Rayner, Sharon Graham, I would love to see them two debate. I think Angela Rayner accused the Unite Union of silly stunts, which I don't know if that means something else. But I'd also love to just hear her say that, silly stunts. But then it turned out that Rayner had already cancelled her membership anyway. Now, what I suppose the question is this always a thing that just happens when Labour get into power, is that their relationship with the unions is largely theoretical until the rare occasions where they have power, and this is always going to happen? Or is this part of like a genuine dissociation going on?
Well, I think both of those can be true, but there is a it is a bit tiresome given how well Tony Blair squared that circle, you know, regardless of what you think about him in his long-term impact on Britain. The stern words, the strong speeches about Clause 4 and so on that he made in various party conferences building up to taking power in 97 meant that the traditional sort of eruption of general strikes and demands that the unions get their due for having supported them, you know, the various MPs was largely quelled, you know, whereas this shower don't seem to have understood. They've gone, no, I don't think we'll go for the new Labour historic three victories in a row. We're going to aim for the Callaghan era. That's the kind of version of Labour we like. You know? Just immense,
you know,
dissatisfaction across the board. I mean, yeah, obviously they did inherit a mess, you know, but if the unions do not understand that we are in an absolutely catastrophic situation now, you know, in terms of every new sideswipe that Labour make at the wealthy just results in tax revenues declining. The capital gains tax has gone. The non-DOMS business has lost us. We've got millionaires lining up at Heathrow every day to get the hell out of there. And they're going to understand pretty soon that you cannot just keep paying people in the public sector what they want if you don't have any wealth creators in the country. I mean, it's such a textbook Labour fucking omni shambles. I despair of. I don't know whether Angela Rayner's memory doesn't go back far enough. I mean, maybe you should have people in important positions in power who can remember what happened the last time their party had a government, or maybe that would help.
It does seem to have happened. There's certain Labour issues that are happening earlier in their time in power than any other time in their most recent 10 years. The other weird thing about Labour being at odds with the union, particularly someone like Angela Rayner, is one of those headlines that kind of jars because you think, well, that's how she cut her teeth, was in local trade unions. It's sort of like finding out that David Attenborough has been suspended by the RSPB. Like they've just he's drifted too far. It's never more compelling than when Labour fight themselves. There's something really intrinsically fascinating about Labour falling out like sort of some big working class family wedding. It happened quite a lot in the Corbyn era, and it's starting to happen now. The problem now is that they're in power.
Well, to be fair, the Tories have fallen out with each other as well and have splintered into various groups, and Reform have only got 5 MPs and they've already splintered into 3 parties.
When the Tories fall out, they always call it a psychodrama. Have you ever worked out why that is, or is that just a suave thing to say that no one really understands the origin of it? Why is it not just a drama?
A psychodrama, I suppose, it implies that nobody's actually been run through with a sword yet, but I don't know.
I always think that the Tories keep like a ceremonial dagger to stab people in the back with. I think it was
the pearl-handled revolver, wasn't it? It was what the Prime Minister was traditionally supposed to shoot themselves. He had a bottle of scotch and a small Saturday night special in the second drawer down in the desk. That was when the men in grey suits.
There was
arrived.
A point where Graham Brady, when he was chair, I think, is he still chair of the 1922 committee, where he was keeping that vulva primed and ready. It was I remember with Liz Truss, it was sort of on the table from the very start.
They should have kept Truss. They should have kept Truss in. They should have ridden that out. We'd be in a much stronger situation now if we had Liz Truss. The shock she's put through the markets is the price of British gilts and so on is not as bad as what Labour have done already, and nobody's talking about it. But she did less damage to our international financial stability than Labour have already done.
Okay, I think that's what's known in the game as a hot take. So if you want to respond to that, whatmostpeoplethinkuk@gmail.com. What most people think. I mean, some of the issues with unions is like, I mean, maybe it was ever thus, but some of the wage settlement claims are almost comically high at the moment. What they're asking for to settle disputes is up there with almost like Dr. Evil in Austin Powers just pulling a fancifully high figure out of their ass. I mean, the BMA having got, I think, a 29% or somewhere in the high 20s, have come back with 29.2%, which I think the 0.2 is brilliant because that's sort of saying, oh, we haven't just pulled this number out of fucking nowhere.
And then they'll agree to shave off the 0.2. That'll be the first negotiating position.
Well, I mean, it is weird with the BMA. People slowly getting their heads around the idea that they are quite a militant union. The TV doctor, Robert Winston. Now, if people don't know who this guy is, he's got quite big, bushy black hair and a bushy tash, and he's got a very friendly face, right? And you might have seen him on Question Time.
He has the controversial view that there are only two sexes and you can't change the one you're born with.
Yeah, years ago, he fucking idiot. He went on TV and just dealt in that absolute madness. So is he really a doctor if he thinks there's only two sexes?
He doesn't understand the gender.
Not even a real doctor, mate. But he went on telly, but he gave an interview where he said that he felt that he couldn't support this. He sort of renounced them and said this is not the right time. The NHS is still getting back on its feet. Where Streeting's gone in quite hard, and early polls show that the public, whereas they were supportive last year, are not supportive this year. So what happens then, Simon? Do the BMA and go, you know what, we might push this a bit far? Or my worry is they'll go, I don't think we've pushed this far enough.
You know what? It's funny, having shown you my problematic bookshelf, this is the psychological insight that Christopher Caldwell in The Age of Entitlement talks about, which is that when people start to get a little bit of some of their grievances addressed, a little bit of a sense that actually there's starting to be some movement, nothing ever satisfies. They just keep pushing and they magnify and they exaggerate and they keep tugging. There's never been an example in history of a union like the junior doctors, whatever they're now called, that
resident.
Yeah, we've got our 30%. That's all we wanted. Back to work, lads. Okay, nice. You know, lovely. No, well, obviously they're weak. Obviously there's further ground that can be gained, you know, and they'll keep pushing. I mean, you and I both work in a field where there hasn't been, I don't think, any serious adjustment in the sort of fees that we earn over the last, I don't know what total inflation has mounted up to since it started in sort of 20.
And if you include the increased price of motoring and hotels, I mean, it's probably for stand-ups, I would say it's literally maybe a 50% wage reduction. But here's the thing, Simon, it's an interesting area to find ourselves in, is the public would think one of the most predominantly left-wing businesses in the world, never had a union. Every time we try to have a union, the problem is it's the opposite of trade union principles, is there's always someone else that will do it for less.
You could probably have a union that would say we need to see a better fees paid at the Comedy Store or some major, you know, on the circuit. Mm. But everyone gets to charge their own price for the tickets when they're on tour. And then the corporates, which are, you know, quite a significant earner for some of us. Yeah, you're right. They'll just go, well, we've got somebody else in a different price bracket then. You know, everybody puts their own price in. You know, everybody is basically
a
free trader, you know. Yeah.
I mean, the closest that the comedy industry ever got to a union, and it still, I think, goes days, the Concerned Comedians Collective. It just marked, that's as far as we were willing to go. We're all on stage, you know, like fucking Wolfie. Give it power to the people. And then when it came to actually the oversight of our own industry, we're concerned and we're a collective. Union's a bit of a strong word.
I think there was, I don't know if you call it a union, but there was some degree of organised, collectivised effort to ensure things like diversity on panel games at one point. I don't know whether that was came from the comedians, though, possibly just within the BBC. But that felt like the closest to sort of union action, demanding that there be women of colour, you know, and so on, represented on TV shows.
If we had a picket line, the problem is it would start decent, but then somebody would get a text saying we've had a pullout.
Exactly.
from a gig, you go, you'd look and go, I think it's that guy. You go, guys, I've had a better offer. So look, I think this is a good example of our comedians' work. We start with high-minded political ideas, but we ended up, we're all hypocrites, and we ended up talking about ourselves. Right, just a quick hype. Some of the tour, some of the big rooms. Let's talk about some of the big rooms I'm playing. It's now literally 2 months till the tour starts. Basic Bloke 2, There's No Bloke Without Fire. Turns out no one likes that title. Every night I say it in the work in progress shows and it gets quite a hostile response. So that was a fuck up. But the show is the best that I've done and the work in progress is the furthest along that I've been. So some of the bigger rooms, Chelmsford, that is its first time I'm playing Chelmsford. That is getting close to being sold out and it's quite a big room. Birmingham is a big room. The Town Hall is going well, but we get plenty of room for more. Reading, similar story. Crawley, again, that's like an 800-seater. Be good to see as many people there as possible. And Leeds went on sale late. It didn't go out. So a lot of people might not have seen Leeds in the first wave. There's a little date in Otley, which is sold out. So if you live in that Yorkshire area, Leeds City Varieties is where you want to come. It's a really nice venue there as well. Probably one of the nicest looking venues in the country. And then just finally, Aldershot. I haven't mentioned Aldershot once. Last time, it really surprised me by having a shitload of people there. And this time, it's really surprised me by being a little bit slow off the mark. So I don't know if what happened last time was some of you in Surrey drove into Aldershot and said, fuck that, I'm never going there again, which I think... I think it's reasonable, or me just continually insulting Aldershot might be why. But yeah, Aldershot was a really good gig last time. It'd be good to see as many of you there as possible. Go to the Live Nation website. And Simon, in terms of stuff to hype for your good self, what should we be pushing out there?
Yeah, you can go to my website, the Simon Evans. So I've got two shows going up in Edinburgh. I'm doing an hour long version of the tour show I've just finished called Have We Met. That was fully 2 hours by the end of it, and so I'm going to have to speak at double speed or carve out a few bits. But that goes on at 2 p.m. every day, and then it's about 6:30, something like that. I'm also at the Caves, my new show, Staring at the Sun, which has not had nearly enough works in progress, to be honest. So bear that in mind. The first week or so might be a little bit varied and chaotic. I'm doing a preview tonight in Walthamstow for it, but that will be going out on tour in start. There's a few in the autumn, but most starts in the spring. And then I will just mention this, if I may. I'm recording both Work of the Devil and Have We Met full-length versions on Sunday and Monday. I think it's the 20th and 21st of September at the Backyard Comedy Club in Bethnal Green. And I'd love to see as many people as possible get there to make sure that that's a good audience for a recording. Those are both polished and finished shows. And so I can say,
I saw both those shows and they were fantastic. I can also say that the Backyard is the venue where Comedy Unleashed happens, which many of the listeners will know. So it's a great venue for comedy. So there's every reason to get down there for that, the recording in mid-September. Right, we're going to talk about trigger warnings now. I haven't spoke about these for a while, but we became used to them being added to comedies from the 70s, maybe 80s a bit, Fawlty Towers and so on, shows being removed, trigger warnings being added. And then it kind of went quiet for a while, but now there's been recent evidence that they're coming for noughties comedies. The Office, you kind of thought, well, you know, I'm not a fan of trigger warnings, but The Office, you sort of take it as read that there'd be a few. But now there's a few popping up on episodes of The Royal Family. I believe that one episode they gave a warning because there's the use of the word batty boy. Now, I do not know what the context was. It was said by Ralph Little's character. I'm going to guess, knowing Ralph Little's oeuvre, that it wasn't said in a hateful way, I guess. But look, the point is not the context. The point is, it's just not even to be angry. So ask, what is the point of a trigger warning, right? Because the moment you watch a show, you can tell by the resolution, the kind of colours, the camera, the fashions, the background, everything. You can tell roughly when a show was made. Most people can, right? So if people understand that the past was different, people said different things, why do we need any... If it says there's a serious sexual assault in this, I almost understand those more. When it's just, oh, they said some hurty words, beyond arse covering, what is the point?
Yeah, I'm totally with you, obviously. You're right. Trigger warnings initially were created to warn people, maybe like students about to study some text that, you know, of ancient Greek or something, where, you know, there's a massive organized rape or and slaughter or whatever, that, and if they've had some sort of experience of that, it might be unpleasant for them. But now it's just simply become a way of scolding the past for not having correct opinions. I find it absolutely sickening. And the arrogance of it as well, the idea that we're all correct now, you know, the means by which we have managed to find a solution to human harmony and so on. The whole point of sitcoms was to show that human beings are, generally speaking, living in slightly sort of dysfunctional, or, you know, interrelationships, that they're forced to live at home with people, or that they're forced to work with people or share other spaces with people that they don't entirely get on with and agree with, you know. So there's bound to be some friction, and the friction was where all the great glories of British sitcom are about grotesques with, you know, unacceptable opinions, you know.
Yeah,
usually
struggling
either
to fit
in positions of power, or at least a little bit pompous, you know. Or I mean, I can't put it in. I know I sound like a, you know, a ridiculous old fool when I say it, but I absolutely despair of this tendency. I just think, like, can you not understand the point of comedy? It's not intended to say this is who you want to be. You know, these people are not like K-pop stars who have got immaculate choreographed routines and no apparent sort of existence between videos. You know, the whole point is it's showing the squalor and the difficulty, and then there's a little bit of resolution at the end. Usually, you know, there's the royal family. If there was a trigger warning you should put on it, is to say, be warned, this may show you that despite poverty and difficult socioeconomic circumstances, this family is full of love. And if your family is not functioning as well, don't blame the fact that your dad isn't earning enough, because these people managed to rub along quite nicely on the DHSS.
Or that the dad doesn't appear to work for a few years and that fecklessness can be contagious, aided and abetted by alcohol and nicotine.
What a patriarch.
What's the point? Remember with The Simpsons, before they focused on the fact that Apu was voiced by a white guy, people used to talk about the stereotype of Apu owning a corner store, and it was a negative stereotype. And I always thought that, that is, I don't know if it's definitely a negative stereotype to have your own business, but it is an old stereotype, and it's got, you know, various connotations, certainly in this country. But also that everyone in The Simpsons is portrayed in a bad way. It was really odd to focus in on that. Like Homer, as a kind of example of white working class masculinity, is awful. I mean, he's a bad husband. He drinks too much. He's overweight. He's thoughtless. Like, it's just so odd when, like, as you say, people take comedies and you go, well, that's why the character is there. That's why the character is like that. I mean, I've sort of said for a while with films that I think that all you really need at the beginning of a film is, like, I think the age rating is a good idea. I think that's a good guide, and it should only ever be a guide. And then just, like, the year that a film was made, because once you know that it was made in 1951, you can sort of do the maths yourself. You don't then to be sort of handheld into the idea. It was made in 1951. Oh, and by the way, some of the stuff that people said in 1951 is in this film that was in 1951.
Well, I don't know. Even 1951, I mean, yeah, you could say that, of course. But 1951, I doubt there's many trigger warnings necessary. Maybe, you know, the dam busters, the dog, you know, that's about, I don't know, that was made during the war, I don't know, but around that time.
But just for the racist and the casual racism, sexism, that anyone with half a brain would know.
Casual racism in 1950s Hollywood movies, hardly any. I mean, I've no doubt somebody will ring in and say, oh, this is you, because you don't see it, Simon. But I don't think there was a great deal.
Or somebody kind of like blacked or browned up or all of that stuff. But what I'm saying is I don't think it needs to be there. I just think that at the very most, you just say this was the year it was made. It's on you to do the fucking research.
What must people think?
So the flip side of that, so I'm sort of having a pop at overly mollycoddling progressives here. Meanwhile, I went to see the Superman film, the new Superman film at cinema last night. And I've got to say, I loved it. My son loved it. I mean, my son came out doing the Superman flying. That is all I want from the Superman film.
Absolutely.
By the way. Right. Yeah. And it was fantastic. And the hero was heroic. He was just heroic. It wasn't one of these modern ones where they question themselves. Throughout, he was basically like, I'm fucking Superman. I'm good. Like, there was no, he didn't deviate from that line, which I thought was great. But there's been some criticism or concerns about the film from the right, is that they're saying, oh, I've heard it's really woke. It's become a habit on the right, probably led by really good cultural commentators like The Critical Drinker, but to really scrutinise any new film for evidence of wokeness. And I don't think it is there. There's a storyline in it about two nations at war, which people have said is an analogy for Israel and Gaza. I'm not sure it completely scans. I think that there are thematic overlaps. I mean, I just think if we've gone from that period, Simon, of the left saying, don't watch this because it's not woke enough, to the right saying, don't watch it because it's woke, there's the same fucking tedious attempt to manage people's behaviour. They can fuck off, all of them, seriously.
Well, I haven't seen the movie. I think most of the reaction was more towards the director. I can't remember his name, but
James Gunn. Yeah,
James Gunn, who gave an interview in which he was talking about, you know, Superman being an immigrant, and if there was a moral or an underlying theme to the movie, it was be kind, as in be kind to immigrants. You know, they enrich our society, and I think a lot of people rolled their eyes at that. Quite rightly, he may have been saying it tongue in cheek, but if he hasn't directed it that way, that's fine.
Yeah, no, I disagree with that. Don't tell. If that theme's in there, let us work it out for itself. But if I was the head of a studio, I'd just say to everyone, just talk about the fucking film, would you? Do you know what I mean? Like, don't try and tell people this is how you should receive it. Because really, yeah, I mean, I suppose that is there a little bit in the film. I mean, Superman, by the way, literally is an immigrant. I mean, he's the furthest traveling immigrant that is there's.
He is an immigrant. You could say he's an immigrant, but that word carries. I mentioned this on GB News and saying if you want to call him an immigrant, I mean, he's a refugee. He's a genuine refugee. His planet's exploded. True. He had no choice. And also, he arrives as an infant, you know. So he is the sort of refugee that we're supposed to think is what's arriving on the boats every day. But it's all right because he assimilates beautifully. He believes in truth, justice, and the American way, you know, and he doesn't bring his weird kryptonite religions with him.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's good. They've got interesting subplots. I don't want to do any spoilers, but yeah, there's certain aspects of the way that they've changed the view, the belief system of Superman's parents that are genuinely interesting. But I just loved him being, I loved the fact, by the way, there was a romantic lead and they were, you know, there was a man and a woman and they fancied each other and they kissed sometimes. That has actually been weirdly...
Trigger warning.
Yeah, well, exactly. There's a straight white man and a woman in this and they get off with each other. Just be aware. Because the Marvel thing did go weirdly sexless the longer it went. They're all like these fucking eunuchs running around with hammers.
Yeah, that's true, that. Although, to be fair, the comics were pretty... The comics had sexy superheroes. There was one called Valkyrie in The Defenders I used to quite fancy.
Yeah.
Who were, you know, sort of blonde sword maiden or whatever. But... I mean, the Fantastic Four had a married couple in it, I think, didn't they?
I think they're coming back as well, yes. So maybe romance is like, if you look at what sells a film, comedy, action, sci-fi, romance, it's so weird to just take that out and go, well, we're not sure how to handle that. Every once in a while, I want to see two of the characters get off with each other. The other thing as well that I thought was good was that they didn't investigate the white savior element of Superman. So this conflict that he intervenes in, you could in another world have applied that logic to it. And I suppose the reason that was on my mind was because of the anniversary of Band-Aid. And I watched a couple of the documentaries on that, of Live Aid rather, and they had to have a voice saying that, well, the white savior element of that was problematic. And I just sort of thought, if you need saving, do you have the luxury of worrying about the color of the savior?
Yeah, very good point. Yeah. I don't know. When you look back, there was a different attitude, wasn't there, to Africa, that it was essentially a basket case and we just needed to feed them, you know, directly, which some people say prevented inflow of investment and so on. Africa had viable industries and high streets and what have you, and what it needed was to be supported in that way. But I tend to be on your side in that, yeah.
Well, I'm at least sympathetic to their motives at the time. Yeah, the lyrics of the Band-Aid song are fucking ridiculous, geographically incorrect.
Well, written on the back of an envelope in sort of 24 hours flat, you know, it's a pretty extraordinary thing to turn around and get going, I think.
In the face of a looming famine, they tried to write a song to stop some people starving to death. The idea that you can't apply a sympathetic read, again, like a historical reading to what they were doing at the time. Maybe it took us too long to realise, like you say, how reductive that was of Africa. It must be weird if you had like a really... if you're a self-made tech billionaire in Ethiopia.
but it was reductive of Africa. It wasn't reductive of the Ethiopian famine, was it? We'd seen the pictures of the people sitting in the middle of a desert without any food and children with distended bellies. And no, that was not reductive. That was what was happening. Whether or not it was our fault is another good question. But, you know, I don't think it was on that occasion remotely. And, it's similar to that thing I was saying earlier about unions. You know, once they get some sort of traction, they just start moving up through the gears. You know, again, well, as soon as you feel like the West is paying attention, it's like, well, you're not paying attention in the right way.
Okay, for the Patreon only section, sticking with a bit of cultural digest, eh? See, I've seen the success of The Rest Is Entertainment. I'm leaning into that. We're going to talk about the Oasis reunion and whether or not that's going to bring back bands. But for everybody else, it'd be the end of the show. Simon, as ever, absolute pleasure to have you on the show. Patrons, always very excited to hear that you're coming back. Just a reminder about the Edinburgh shows. Just remind us and about the recordings.
Yeah, Caves, 2 p.m. for the Have We Met Victory Lap, and then the new show, I think it's 6 or 6.30 p.m. also at the Caves, which are on... I can never remember. What is it called, that little road, the deep down in the belly of Edinburgh, the sort of underground section?
Cowgate, yeah.
That's right, where the old Gilded Balloon used to be, yeah. And then the Staring at the Sun tour will be off and running mainly in the spring. And those two shows being recorded at Backyard, the Unleashed venue in Bethnal Green, 2021 of September, I think.
And you know the good news is that my Edinburgh time, 3.30, you can do a Simon Evans, Jeff Norcott doubleheader, no worries at all.
Fantastic.
And a couple. I'm only up there 14 dates, but I think three of them have sold out. So if you do want to come to Edinburgh, it's not a massive, massive room that I'm in. So do get the tickets in. And I will be back later this week. There's so much happening at the moment politically. I'll be back with another breaking news.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.